Hello and welcome to the New York Times Magazine program. I'm Julie Mink, volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona. In this edition of the New York Times Magazine for November 17th, 2024, the cover story, Nature's Swiss Army Knife, What Can We Learn from Venom? And then, he thought he knew horses, then he learned to really listen. But first, Nature's Swiss Army Knife, What Can We Learn from Venom? A study of Gila monster venom helped start the revolution in weight loss drugs, but scientists think that's just the beginning. This article was written by Kim Tingley. There are two opposite paths to achievement in science. The first is straightforward. Identify a problem and set about solving it. The second is rather unscientific sounding and perhaps more faith-based. Study in obscurity and hope serendipity strikes. In 1980, a young gastroenterologist named Jean-Pierre Roffman wound up taking the latter road through the digestive diseases branch of the National Institutes of Health. His goal there was to gain research experience. While doing so, he chanced to meet the lead chemist of another laboratory, John Pisano, who had a passion for seeking out new and interesting examples of a specific kind of hormone called a peptide in animal venoms. Pisano regularly appealed to local insect and reptile enthusiasts in the classified pages of the Washington Post. In response, they would show up at his office door carrying plastic bags wriggling with possibility. Pisano offered some venom samples to Roffman for his meandering analyses. Over the following month, Roffman experimented with them to see if they stimulated pancreatic cells harvested from guinea pigs. The venom with the biggest effect by far came from a desert reptile that Roffman had never heard of, the Gila monster. Gila monsters, sluggish, thick-tailed ground dwellers, are native to southern Arizona and northern Mexico. They have blunt noses and bumpy black skin with tan, pink, or orange squiggles. They spend 95% of their lives underground. Like their cousins to the south, Mexican beaded lizards, they are one of the very few lizard species that produces venom, which they excrete from mouth glands into grooves in their serrated teeth. The strength of their jaws is typically enough to subdue their prey, chicks, frogs, worms, and the like. But if threatened and unable to escape or hide, they may bite a predator. Whenever they clamp down, piercing the skin, venom enters the victim's bloodstream. This causes intense pain and can initiate a cascade of other symptoms that, in people, includes vomiting, dizziness, rapid heart rate, low blood pressure, and, in rare circumstances, death. Roffman experimented with the Gila monster venom for a while, then moved on to other projects. Years passed. He took a faculty position at what was then the State University of New York Health Science Center in Brooklyn and set up his own lab. Soon he found himself collaborating with a group at the Veterans Affairs Medical Center in the Bronx. One of the scientists there, an endocrinologist named John Eng, was impressed by Roffman's work with the Gila monster. He was especially intrigued by its glacial metabolism. The lizard can survive on fewer than a handful of meals per year. Eng and Roffman paired up, screened the venom again, and found molecules Roffman had not observed before. They called these molecules exendin 3 and 4. Eng recognized the exendins as a potential diabetes therapy. He had patients with the condition who needed to calibrate their insulin injections carefully to avoid both hyper- and hypoglycemia. Exendin 4, on the other hand, resembled a human hormone called GLP-1, which works as a natural insulin manager in people without diabetes. When we eat, the small intestine releases GLP-1, prompting the pancreas to produce more insulin only when blood sugar levels get too high. The molecule also slows digestion and makes us feel full. Scientists suspected that injections of GLP-1 would be a much easier and safer diabetes treatment than insulin, except for one crucial problem. The hormone lasts only a few minutes in the bloodstream before it breaks down. But the Gila Monster analog, Eng and Rothman were surprised to note, lasts for hours. Eng was eager to patent the Xenden molecules. The VA declined to do so. It didn't see any obvious benefits for veterans. Rothman opted out too. Diabetes wasn't his area, and patenting molecules wasn't common practice then. You did science, people read your papers, he told me. What they went on to do with what they learned was their business. Yet, Eng persisted. He patented the molecule at his own expense in 1995 and spent vacation time calling pharmaceutical companies, trying to get them to develop it into a drug. Ultimately, he licensed the patent to a startup called Amylin Pharmaceuticals for less than $1 million. In 2002, Eli Lilly and Company agreed to pay up to $325 million to Amylin for its drug exenatide. Under the brand name Byetta, exenatide was approved by the Food and Drug Administration for the treatment of type 2 diabetes in 2005. Patients who took Byetta and other Xenden and GLP-1-inspired drugs also experienced substantial weight loss, trials revealed, but pharmaceutical companies were slow to realize how useful that side effect could be. Once they did, and had improved their formulations, the consequences transformed society. Ozempic and Wegovy, followed by Mounjaro and Zepbound, became blockbuster drugs for treating diabetes and spurring weight loss. What's more, many of them appear to have additional beneficial impacts that researchers are only beginning to understand. Some seem to be protective against kidney and heart disease and may reduce inflammation in the brain that is linked to the development of Parkinson's and Alzheimer's. You might say that the Gila Monster, this shy subterranean reptile, harbored a blueprint all along for medicines that may be among the most consequential health advances of our time. Medical interest in venom has long centered, reasonably enough, on snake bites. As many as 5.5 million people per year, usually agricultural workers and children in Africa, Asia, and Latin America, are bitten by venomous snakes. Those bites are responsible for more than 100,000 deaths, along with many more amputations, leading the World Health Organization to declare them a neglected public health issue. But most venomous interactions take place outside our awareness, among invertebrates that we are liable to squish without a second thought. Now that researchers can, with the tiniest venom sample, identify every constituent molecule down to the last amino acid, they are discovering substances of extraordinary complexity. Tarantula venom, for example, contain more than 100 molecules. In the venoms of some spiders and snails, that number runs into the thousands. Venom is generally considered distinct from poison. Whereas poison is passive, a substance like a laundry detergent pod or berries from a black nightshade plant that can be lethal if ingested, venom must be actively administered by an animal, often via fangs, teeth, or barbs, usually to capture prey or defend against predators. Nature has engineered this capacity surprisingly often. There are at least 1,250 species of venomous catfish alone, each with its own venom formula. Venomous creatures include insects, spiders, corals, mollusks, snakes, lizards, and a few mammals, platypuses, shrews. Many of them, such as marine species, are difficult to observe in their natural habitats, and so we know next to nothing about how and why they use their toxins. But in the venoms of creatures that researchers have been able to examine more closely, two features stand out that hint at their significant medical potential. They are incredibly potent and fast-acting, necessary qualities if they are to aid the survival prospects of the creatures deploying them. They can be produced in advance and stored for long periods at ambient temperature in the animal's glands. They are composed of hundreds or sometimes thousands of molecules that often serve multiple purposes, making venoms essentially ecological Swiss Army knives, as a 2019 review in the journal Toxins put it. And a majority of those molecules are peptides and proteins honed over millions of years to target other animals in the host's ecosystem, including plenty of creatures whose biology overlaps that of humans. Peptides have long been especially tantalizing for drug discovery. These molecules are composed of short chains of between 2 and 50 amino acids, the building blocks of proteins. They are smaller and simpler than proteins are. Yet they are larger and more complex than the molecules, consisting of a single atom or atoms bonded together that are used in most drugs. Such drug formulations can slip unnoticed through the membranes of cells and influence how they function. Peptides, by contrast, must engage with particular receptors on cell surfaces. Because these surface receptors differ considerably depending on what role the cells play, any peptide that manages to interact with them tends to have a highly specific impact. The first peptide used for therapeutic purposes was the hormone insulin, which Canadian researchers extracted from the dog pancreas in 1921. It soon began to be harvested and purified from the pancreas of pigs and cows. Human insulin wasn't synthesized in a lab until 1978. In general, peptides have limitations that make them less than ideal for commercial development. For example, they typically need to be injected into the bloodstream because they are quickly digested if swallowed, and even then they have a relatively short biological half-life. Since the late 19th century, researchers have known that snake venoms contain amino acids and therefore probably proteins as well, and their profound and varied effect on human cells was easy to see. Cobras, mambas, and other members of the elapid family, snakes whose fangs are always erect, deploy powerful neurotoxins that paralyze the muscles, eyelids first, then skeletal muscles and diaphragm, until a victim asphyxiates. This prevents their prey from struggling while they eat it. Vipers, on the other hand, including rattlesnakes and adders, have fangs that fold back when not in use. Their venom breaks down blood vessels, causing profuse bleeding, which leads to clots, strokes, and other related damage. When a rattlesnake bites, it's like a shotgun blast. Stephen McKessie, a biology professor at the University of Northern Colorado, told me, it knocks out of kilter a lot of different control systems. Whether or not something is damaging or beneficial, however, depends on the dose and the context. In the 1960s, John R. Vane, a British pharmacologist who would go on to unravel the anti-inflammatory effects of aspirin, was studying hypertension when a postdoctoral student from Brazil joined his lab. The student, Sergio Ferreira, brought with him peptides from the venom of the Brazilian viper Bothrops jararaca, which he had shown could dilate blood vessels, allowing more blood to flow through them. Too much of the peptide helped cause the unchecked bleeding characteristic of viper bites, but the lab discovered that the peptide could also block an enzyme known as ACE that causes hypertension. The peptide became the model for the first ACE inhibitor, captopril, which the FDA approved in 1981 to treat high blood pressure. It went on to become a billion-dollar drug. The use of Exendin 4 to develop exenatide, the diabetes drug, was very likely the first occasion when venom was co-opted to serve a metabolic function in people. Even so, it has remained unclear why the lizard would have a metabolic hormone in its venom. In fact, the central mystery of nearly all venoms is their extravagant complexity. The Blue Mountains funnel web spider of southeastern Australia, for example, has 3,000 molecules in its toxic cocktail, one of which happens to be deadly to humans. Are those thousands of other molecules vestiges of the evolutionary process, the spider version of our appendix, say? Or might each one serve a contemporary purpose? Stephen Trim was a molecular biologist at the pharmaceutical giant Pfizer when he realized that his hobby, keeping pet snakes and spiders, could be critical to his career. Trim's team had been tasked with developing new pain treatments by identifying molecules that could turn off specific nerve cells. Making their project trickier, those molecules would also have to ignore other, similar-seeming cells that take care of processes like breathing and heart pumping. Most drugs in use today aren't so discriminating. Instead, they enter all kinds of cells and cause all sorts of outcomes, some of them beneficial, but others unpleasant or even dangerous as side effects. Trim began his search, as he usually did, looking through research publications for any mention of the cells he was trying to turn off. He was in luck. An academic group had indeed found a substance that could engage them, a tarantula's venom. Naturally, Trim wanted to test that venom on his cell cultures. And because tarantula venom contains hundreds of molecules, he hoped to purchase it already sequenced or separate it into its component parts. Unfortunately, such a product didn't exist. The problem, as far as he could tell, was that the people who study tarantula venom are biologists, and they generally lack the experience and technology to sequence it efficiently. On the flip side, his pharma colleagues had the tools and know-how to dismantle and reassemble infinitesimal droplets, but they tended to think of venom, if they thought about it at all, as a blunt instrument of pain and death, not a treasure trove of compelling molecular designs. And of course, they had no idea where to get it. Trim did, though, because he and his wife Carol, a cancer biologist, happened to have several tarantulas in their menagerie at home. The question confronting him was, how? In February 2010, Pfizer downsized its facility in Sandwich, England, where Trim worked. Laid off, severance in hand, he formed a new company less than a month later, VenomTech. In one of his first acts to set up his business, Trim bought carbon dioxide from an aquarium supply store and, on his dining room table, began to experiment with anesthetizing spiders. He needed to be sure he could harvest their venom without hurting them. He later found that a tarantula's heart can stop for as long as 10 minutes before it starts beating on its own again. "We didn't have that defined knowledge of what is dead," he told me. "We often step off the edge of science." When I visited the lab in April, VenomTech had 4 employees and rented laboratory space on the mostly vacant Pfizer campus where Trim previously worked. It exported the product Trim wanted to buy years earlier, venoms separated into their constituent molecules. At that point, Trim said that success of recent diabetes drugs had yet to kickstart a race to exploit venomics to find more human therapies. indeed persuading would-be customers to invest in the Venomic future he knew was coming was his main challenge as an entrepreneur. It proved insurmountable. 4 months later, he ran out of money and was forced to liquidate the company. Our view of venom as a weapon turns out to underestimate the fecundity of natural selection. Tawny crazy ants used their venom as an antidote to the venom of fire ants. Moles and shrews paralyze earthworms and insects so that they stay put in their larder and are fresh when it's time to eat them. Jewel wasps sting cockroaches with a serum that turns them into zombies that willingly accompany the wasps back to their lair to be devoured by their larvae. The venom of bees and many other invertebrates is painful but deliberately not fatal, presumably so that victims will survive to teach their offspring and other members of their species to avoid the stinger. Assassin bugs make at least two kinds of venom and can choose which to use in a given situation. Occasionally, the redeployment of the molecules found in venom for human needs are nearly as clever. Glenn King, a molecular biology professor in the Division of Chemistry and Drug Discovery at the University of Queensland in Australia, first became interested in toxins in the mid-1990s, a period of mounting concern about the environmental impact of chemical pesticides. Where could we find some natural insecticides that were more eco-friendly? King asked me. In retrospect, the answer was obvious. Spiders. They've been working on it for millions of years. Vestaron Crop Protection, which King founded before later selling his stake, manufactures his bioinsecticides. King switched his focus to medical applications when he realized that many venom peptides, especially those of smaller invertebrates, target ion channels. An ion is an atom or molecule with a positive or negative charge. Ion channels function as gates that determine which ions can enter or leave a cell, thereby activating or deactivating that cell by changing its voltage. Ion channels are critical to countless basic functions. They have been implicated in conditions from diabetes to cancer to epilepsy to autoimmune disorders to chronic pain. There are a lot of them in the brain and nervous system, where cells signal one another electrically. A peptide of considerable interest to King is found in spider venom. In rodent trials, injecting it as many as 8 hours after a stroke resulted in 60% less neural damage from oxygen deprivation compared with those rodents that didn't get the treatment. Other applications being investigated in other labs include a scorpion peptide that binds precisely to malignant tumors, including those in the brain. This peptide is engineered to be fluorescent so that during surgery to remove a tumor, doctors can see whether they have cut it all out. Eventually, similar molecules may be programmed to kill cancer cells outright without chemotherapy or radiation, says Jim Olson, a professor at the Seattle Children's Research Institute and the University of Washington, who initiated the project. A peptide from sea anemone venom is in clinical trials as a treatment for some autoimmune diseases, according to Christine Beaton, the immunologist leading the investigations at the Baylor College of Medicine. In Brazil, a biochemist and neuroscientist, Maria Helena de Lima, is developing a peptide derived from the venom of a banana spider to treat erectile dysfunction. Ion channels can be tough to manipulate with lab-designed molecules. Finding those molecules in nature, though, at least when it comes to venom, means bridging a crucial gap between what biologists know about how a certain creature uses its venom and what clinicians know would help their patients. This is the gap that Stephen Trim set out to close. Before Venom Tech folded, he has since started another company, Ventera Bio Limited, to develop biopesticides. he would collect all the venomous creatures he could get his hands on and milk them every few weeks, snakes less often than spiders because snakes yield so much venom. That was a bit like juicing an orange, he told me. It just pours out. Then he used liquid chromatography to separate out the different chemical components and mass spectrometry to identify them based on the weight and charge of their atoms. When I toured VenomTech's lab, I was impressed by the equipment. The liquid chromatography machine retailed for more than Trim's first house. But more spectacular was the entire wall filled with translucent plastic boxes containing tarantulas, scorpions, and centipedes. From a bin on the floor came a faint earthy aroma of locusts that served as their food source. The day I arrived, two clinical pharmacology students, Elfreda Botneng and Rahaf Mohammed, were starting a 6-week internship in the lab as part of their program at City St. George's, an institute at the University of London. Trim's senior lab technician, Stuart Baker, was showing them how to work with the invertebrates. For the students' first try, Baker selected a Chilean rose tarantula from the shelf as a sommelier might a fine wine. "They're one of the most chilled-out spiders you can get," he announced. He handed Botneg the top third of a plastic Coke bottle to scoop the spider up with. Mohammed took video with her phone as Botneg gingerly lifted the spider out of its habitat and slid it into a container with a hole for adding carbon dioxide. "How was it?" Mohammed asked. "Scary," Botneg replied. One of VenomTech's customers was Helena Safavi, an associate professor of biochemistry at the University of Utah, who studies the chemical composition of venom made by cone snails, marine mollusks with beautiful patterned shells. Safavi was born in Iran and grew up in Germany, where she learned to scuba dive in a murky lake. When she finally got to see a coral reef, she was captivated. Not by the spectrum of colors or the diversity of species, so much as by the sheer density of their interactions with one another. "You have bubbles all over your face," she told me. "You don't understand what's going on around you. You're basically in this soup, both chemically and biologically." There are about 1,000 species of cone snail, and some of them prey on fish and worms and other snails by injecting them with potent neurotoxins. One such toxin is so powerful that it has been known to kill divers who pick the snails up to admire them. The federal government regulates the possession of a few dozen substances, and this type of cone snail venom, like botulinum, is one of them. Utah already had a robust cone snail research program when Safavi arrived a decade ago. In the early 1990s, a professor there, Baldomero Oliveira, had been studying the venoms of two cone snail species to understand how they paralyzed fish when he figured out that their venoms contained peptides that could block a reaction in the human spinal cord that registers pain. One of the peptides eventually became an analgesic, ziconotide, that was approved by the FDA in 2004. Safavi is a rising star in the field of venom therapeutics, Glenn King says. In 2015, she published, along with Oliveira and 14 other colleagues, a paper describing the unexpected discovery that, although cone snails are notorious for their neurotoxins, two species target fish by hijacking their metabolism instead. The snails release a venom containing insulin into the water, disabling nearby fish by rendering them essentially hypoglycemic. The fish become uncoordinated and can experience seizures or pass out, just as a person with low blood sugar might. This allows the snail to swallow the fish whole through its rostrum, an appendage that looks like a mouth. In a windowless room, Safavi and a postdoctoral fellow, Americ Rogalski, showed me two aquarium tanks with snails in them. Dragging their shells, they had left ruts on the sandy bottom before disappearing beneath its surface. Only their brightly colored snorkel-like siphons poked out to draw water in over their gills. Rogalski is a biologist who studies the snail's behavior. He is also the lab member charged with extracting their venom, which he does by tricking them into reacting to a vial concealed beneath the fin of a fish. The snails shoot the vial with a hollow, chitinous harpoon, which at other times they keep retracted within their shell, and plunge their toxin through it as if it were a hypodermic needle. Rogalski's task demanded patience. He had to dangle a dead zebrafish in the water and wait for one of them to show interest. "They're snails," he said, "so they take their time." Technology has advanced so far that chemists need barely any venom at all to be able to determine its amino acid sequence and replicate it synthetically. There are even large online databases containing the sequences of hundreds of venom peptides, and researchers can use this information to make discoveries without ever seeing a cone snail. "Some of us are a little bit sad that the technology is getting so good," Safavi told me. "It makes fieldwork less important." Organizing collection trips and arranging the necessary permits can take years, and some locations are too dangerous to visit. Such excursions, though, are still the only way to find snails whose venom is new to science. "We have a whole long list of species we would love to sequence and cannot get our hands on," she told me. All the while, climate change is decimating coral reefs around the world. Many snails that Safavi might be able to find today will be extinct before she can reach them. "In an ideal world, we would just sequence everything right now," she said, "but I don't see that happening." One morning in Utah, Safavi and I walked into a coffee shop and heard a bang. A sparrow that got indoors had flown into the front window. In a flash, Safavi pulled off her canvas jacket to use as an impromptu net. She and a member of the kitchen staff eventually shooed the bird out through the back door. I came to think that what venom researchers grasp better than everyone else, but what they have yet to make the rest of us understand, is more fundamental and less lucrative than the possibly unlimited utility of other organisms to humans. They appreciate that we are all sparrows, snakes, spiders, snails, at the most foundational molecular level, the same. Venom researchers are thus burdened, in a sense, with a close-up view not just of our annihilation of the natural world, but of the intricacy and interconnectedness of all the organisms we are snuffing out. Christine Beaton told me that she has stopped squashing spiders. "We are probably scratching the surface of venoms that are beneficial," she says. "Each time we destroy a little piece of the environment, how many little spiders are in there, or centipedes that might be a little pharma company on their own?" Glenn King notes that 99% of the venomous creatures in the world are invertebrates. They produce such tiny quantities of venom that 20 years ago, we had no way to determine its composition. I think in the next decade, people are going to be pulling out these really interesting drugs from bugs we've never heard of, he told me. David Julius, a molecular biologist at the University of California, San Francisco, has used spider venom to activate the cellular receptors for temperature and touch to see what those molecules look like and how they work, research for which he won the 2021 Nobel Prize in Physiology or Medicine. Julius notes that venom, in addition to being valuable as a reservoir of potential pharmaceuticals, can provide powerful tools for basic research. "It's still a great resource, largely untapped, for molecules that, if they don't become drugs, can tell us about how to design drugs," he says. But first, To tap that source, somebody somewhere has to capture a Gila monster, or a viper, or a cone snail, or a spider, and milk it. While I was at Venom Tech, Baker showed Boutneg and Muhammad how to complete that process. The students had used carbon dioxide to put a tarantula to sleep. Boutneg tipped its container upside down, and the spider flopped onto its back. She took off the lid and probed it with forceps. When it didn't flinch, she slid tweezers under its fangs. They moved easily, which meant the spider was inert. Baker demonstrated how to grip its abdomen between its four sets of legs and lift it out of the box. "You pick it up with your hands?" Muhammad asked. I got a turn, too. We all wore gloves. The spider's heft between my thumb and forefinger was startling at first, like a supple set of car keys. Until that moment, I had not thought much about a spider's insides. Do tarantulas have stomachs, brains, lungs? Yes, yes, yes. Under Baker's direction, I set the spider on a pedestal that held a little test tube. We enfolded its fangs, at rest they're tucked in, aimed at the abdomen, and pointed them down into the tube. Then we positioned tiny electrodes just above them on either side of the spider's chelicerae, its mouth parts. Baker told me to rest my finger on the spider's cephalothorax, what I would have called its head, so that its fangs didn't pop out, and then he zapped it with a jolt of electricity. The spider's legs twitched, and venom trickled out of its fangs and into the tube. After a few more zaps, I lifted it back into its terrarium to recover, more gently than I would have before. Kim Tingley, who wrote this article, is a contributing writer for the magazine. Her recent features have included articles about what living in space might do to the human body and the potential health impacts of exposure to forever chemicals. And now I would like to just take a moment to remind you that you are listening to the New York Times Magazine program. I'm Julie Mink, volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona. And now, our next article. He thought he knew horses, then he learned to really listen. Warwick Schiller made his name as an expert trainer. An enigmatic little horse completely changed his outlook. This article was written by Sterry Butcher. Sterry Butcher is a writer in Marfa, Texas, where she lives on a farm with horses and donkeys. Horses are exquisite machines. As prey animals, their greatest survival tool are designed for flight, and every sense is finely geared toward safety. In the wild, they spend the entirety of their lives within the eyesight of another horse. Even domestic horses who don't venture beyond their pasture will take turns staying awake while others sleep. They can see nearly 360 degrees and can focus on two objects at once, one from each eye. They evolved to mosey along, grazing for up to 16 hours a day, using whiskers on their muzzle to discern, in part, tender grass from rocks. Their hide is so sensitive to touch that they can feel a single fly land on their body and wriggle the skin underneath to send it aloft. Their sense of smell is almost as keen as a dog's. Horses form friendships, and friends stand nose to rump to cooperatively swish flies from the other's face with their tails. They'll rake their teeth against the other's withers or back, scratching places the other cannot reach on his own. Where our brains are outfitted with a prefrontal cortex that allows for planning, organizing, setting goals, and decision-making, a horse has virtually none. They experience thoughts and emotions without the benefit of evaluation, and although they can remember a great deal, they don't think about what they want to do tomorrow, which makes them geniuses at living in the present. Since they fear they may die without the collective protection of the group, they are experts at coexisting. They just want to get along. In the roughly 5,500 years since their domestication, horses have continuously been in our service, whether it's to charge into battle, race chariots, hunt buffalo, bust sod, carry the mail, run, leap, and pull at our bidding, or more recently and mundanely, tote kids around a ring in a county 4-H show. Despite this long and intimate association, interspecies communication can be tricky, and things between horses and people don't always go so well. Horses can shy or bolt. They can buck, bite, or plant their feet and refuse to go forward. Frustration for both horse and owner can begin to build, and with it grows the possibility for getting hurt. That's where trainers like Warwick Schiller come in, bridging the knowledge gap between people and their mounts. His methods for improving steering or loading a reluctant horse into a trailer weren't too different from those of the rest of the horse world. Lots of folks can teach an anxious horse to achieve a more relaxed state of mind by circling to a stop or to keep a steady pace within a gate. And horses, they're the same everywhere, generally willing to try to do what a person demands, even if the request is clumsy. Horses in the wild show almost no infirmity, Schiller explains. They're good at pretending they're okay. They'll take a lot of heavy-handed training, and a lot of people with horses are fine with that. The horses still work for them. Lately, though, Schiller has strayed from solving horse and rider issues through straight techniques or drills. Instead, he has delved into a place where the horse-human relationship is more about cooperation than obedience, more process than product, and where horsemanship is less about a perfectly executed stop or achieving a snappy flying lead change than it is about creating mutual trust and understanding. That message resonates well beyond the trainer himself. On a late spring morning last year, Schiller, wearing a shirt that read, "Professional Horse Petter," sat with a clutch of 12 people under oak trees at the Paso Robles, California ranch he owns with his wife, Robin. The group was there for a 3-day clinic, and among them were a retired firefighter with a filly who didn't steer well, an entrepreneur with a PhD in leadership who worried about ruining her new horse, and a lawyer with a steed that found grass more motivational than her owner. There was also Chelsea Warriner, who bought a horse after selling her family's restaurant in 2021. Two bolting incidents resulted in 2 trips to the emergency room for her. "I ended up humbled and hurt," she told the group through tears. Despite her terrifying accidents, she bought a steadier mount that was disinclined to hold a trot and opted not to travel in straight lines. "We've struggled with connecting," she said. "We're still working on it." The clinic attendees were already fans of Schiller's. Each was a member of his monthly subscription service, which offers hundreds of instructional videos and occasional Zoom sessions with him. More than 145,000 people follow his YouTube channel, where his training videos top 30 million views. In clips like "Arabian Horses Are Crazy," "Or Are They?" or "Helping an Anxious Off-the-Track Thoroughbred Find Relaxation," Schiller never seems rushed or worried, even if there's a horse pitching around the pen or at the end of its lead. His voice doesn't rise. He's affectionate with the horses he encounters, offering a "hello there" when they reach out a nose to investigate his hand. He never seemed annoyed by either horse or rider, even when the human fumbles in the effort to do what Schiller asks. He is largely a problem solver, not unlike the many other trainers with an online presence, those who have become television personalities on RFD TV, or who have their own popular YouTube channels filled with advice on how to fix behaviors or improve performance. Your horse bucks under saddle? Here's how to change that. What sets Schiller apart is a vulnerability that has been minted in real time, in front of his followers and his audiences, as he experiments with incorporating the horse's emotional intelligence into more traditional training methods. And along the way, somewhat unexpectedly, communing with horses in this fashion has led Schiller to arrive at a new understanding of both horses and himself. "I think horses lead us to consciousness," he says. "I think that's what they're here for." Schiller grew up in Young, a small community in New South Wales, Australia. His father was a ranch hand at a 1,200-acre sheep and wheat farm and rode bulls, twice earning a spot at Australia's national rodeo finals, winning it once. His mother worked at the local Society of St. Vincent de Paul's charity shop. As a child, Schiller showed horses and pored over the family's Western Horseman magazines, riveted by American cowboys and their horses. He landed a job at age 23 riding colts for a California horseman who told him he had promise. For much of his career, Schiller specialized in reining competitions where horse and rider run patterns of circles, stops, and slides that require precise control of speed and responsiveness. He performed at the discipline's highest levels, posting wins at major shows. Twice, along with Robin, he represented Australia at the World Equestrian Games. He coached clients to achieve reining titles of their own and demonstrated his training techniques in a series on Farm and Ranch TV. Over time, his knack for communicating well with horses and people garnered notice. "I started getting a lot of phone calls, 'Would you do clinics?' And I started doing them, flying all over the place. When I was doing clinics, I realized there are some common misunderstandings about horses, so I thought, I'll make videos and put them on YouTube to help people out." By 2015, he focused on creating video content while also traveling nationally and internationally, helping clinic participants with their balky pony, their horse that didn't want to back up, the one that spooked on trail rides. His schedule was packed. Things were great. Couldn't be better. It might have gone on like that indefinitely, but surprising things can happen with horses. Sometimes, it turns out, the teachers themselves need teaching. In 2016, a little red horse called Sherlock stood in the Schiller's barn. He was Robin's new reining mount, a talented athlete who was nonetheless a puzzle. He was obedient, but without curiosity or spark, so emotionally distant that he never ambled over to say hello to his people. His anxiety showed up in his body, where an imperfect stride or two in an otherwise solid reining performance consistently kept him out of the blue ribbons. Schiller turned to his arsenal of training techniques to soften and refine the horse, and yet Sherlock's tension and flat affect remained unchanged. The glum little horse stayed glum. "He had a few issues that I thought I could fix quite easily," Schiller says, "because it seemed pretty normal. But this horse had a level of shutdown I'd not ever encountered before. Nothing that I knew could get him out of it." So he experimented. He spent time just watching the horse in his pen. When Schiller moved a step or two toward Sherlock, Schiller stopped at the flick of the horse's ear or shift of his gaze. If Schiller moved back, the horse might sigh or slightly lower his head. If Sherlock turned to look at cackling chickens in the barnyard, Schiller looked too. If Sherlock moved off to graze, the trainer kept pace on a parallel path. He realized that the horse's indications of stress were significantly more subtle and meaningful than he previously understood. That was the start of communicating awareness, he says. "I had no idea what I was doing." He was on the right track. Researchers are discovering that horses may have far greater sensitivity than we ever knew. The heart rate of horses in a 2016 University of Sussex study went up or down accordingly when shown photographs of angry or friendly human faces, demonstrating that not only can they discriminate between positive and negative expressions, but they can do so in a species not their own. Another study in 2020 confirmed that they can recognize their keeper in photographs even after a 6 month separation. In the 1970s and beyond, a few revered American trainers in a genre that's loosely called natural horsemanship brought the horse's inherent acuity to the attention of clinic crowds or in books they wrote. They spoke in semi-ciphers about the horse and handlers following each other's feel and needing to reward the horse's slightest effort. One of these well-known mantras is attributed to the renowned trainer Ray Hunt, who died in 2009. "A horse knows when you know and knows when you don't know." As he worked at unraveling Sherlock's mysteries, Schiller began considering the Hunt quote in a different light. "I always thought that meant that they know if you know what you're doing or if you don't," he says. Maybe, he thought, it had more to do with a horse's knowing that you're truly present with them. Horses do a lot of stuff to determine their level of safety around us. I started noticing things and letting Sherlock know I noticed things. Something weird was happening to Schiller, too. While lecturing at a big horse expo in Madison, Wisconsin, Schiller found himself deviating from his standard talk, divulging keenly personal issues like old childhood hurts. He returned to his expo booth rattled, and the woman in the neighboring booth asked how it had gone. "I feel like I've been run over by a truck," he told her. "I don't know what it was. I admitted to some things that I'd probably never admitted to myself to a room full of strangers." "Oh," the woman said, "like Brené Brown says, vulnerability is the ultimate badass." Schiller went home and devoured Brown's books. One passage stood out among all the others. "We cannot selectively numb emotions. When we numb the painful emotions, we also numb the positive emotions." Schiller remained perplexed by Sherlock's interior demeanor, detached yet obedient. While thinking about him one day, the Brown quote surfaced in his mind. As a child, his family hewed to the principles that boys don't cry, show fear, or allow themselves to grieve. We'd go to a funeral and it would be, "Oh, well, he's dead, no use worrying about that." He understood that from early on, his emotions had been tamped down, discouraged to surface, and that he had remained that way. "That's when I realized, that's Sherlock," he says. "Sherlock is me." Working with the horse awakened Schiller to other aspects of his own character. Old habits, like an inclination to talk at people instead of to people, started to fall away. "It's from horses where I learned to listen," he says, "listening instead of telling." What followed was a period of self-discovery that continues even now. Tons of reading, ice baths, a man's emotional retreat, therapy, traditional and otherwise. Schiller guilelessly covered his evolution in his Journey On podcast, whose rapid popularity led to an annual meeting where podcast guests and fans co-mingle and plumb the horse-human realm. In one episode featuring the horse trainer Nashawn Cook, the conversation wheeled from comparative religion to James Baldwin to Schiller's challenges with Sherlock. "I stepped back from trying to make him any different and trying to change him," Schiller said of the horse. "I really started exploring other stuff, and some of that other stuff led me to explore my own stuff, led me to going and seeing therapists and learning a lot about trauma and the autonomic nervous system and different states of arousal. And yeah, it was a horse that led me down that garden path." It's a horse that shows up as the master you need so that you can continue to stay alive while you're living, Cook replied. Weekend clinics filled Schiller's schedule, a perfect testing ground for his new ideas about attunement. In time, Sherlock's attitude brightened and his optimism and curiosity bloomed. A few months into this exploration, Schiller encountered Cody, a Mustang in Texas with a bolting problem. In that clinic, Cody repeatedly turned his head in such a way that he blocked Schiller and his owner from seeing his right eye, so distrustful that he could not face them. Schiller spent time approaching Cody by taking a step or two and retreating a step or two, according to the Mustang's subtle signals of concern. After a while, Schiller told the owner to simply stand and hold the lead rope. Within minutes, the horse, finally sensing he was protected, dropped to the ground and slept, and then slept again through the next day's activities. The Mustang showed Schiller that if he could unravel the reasons behind the bolting, instead of simply fixing the bolting itself, the problem might not reoccur. Cody was the eye-opening moment where I realized the importance of our awareness and how it allows horses to feel safe around us, he wrote in his book, The Principles of Training. I had let him know that I was very present. This approach was unlike any other way I would normally suggest solving a bolting issue, like having the rider calmly reach wide with one rein and bend the bolting horse into a circle until he slowed. But ever since then, I have taken much more care with working through the slightest level of tension in a horse. The Mustang's owner later reported the horse no longer bolted. He understood that his rider could focus on what mattered. What you find is the more that you communicate that you're listening, Schiller says, a lot of times the behaviors go away. To swing a leg over and sit astride a horse is to encounter its magical aliveness. A rider feels the horse's ribcage expand as it sighs, feels its sides quiver, feels through the reins the push of its tongue as it adjusts the bit in its mouth. There is life in the heat and dusty scent they generate, and in the great thrust of power and roll of its body as it pushes off into a walk. The rider can feel anxiety coil and buzz inside the horse and feel it unfurl as the horse calms. A thoughtful rider is aware, moment by moment, of what the horse's ears are doing, where its gaze falls, the cadence, speed, and movement of its feet, the rhythm of its breathing, and where its mood or thoughts lie. When horse and rider drop into the same current, minds and bodies converge, and alertness and athleticism flow in equal measure. Getting there, though, isn't easy. I am so very sorry, but that is all the time we have for this edition of the New York Times Magazine program. I'm Julie Mink, volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona. Please join me again for the New York Times Magazine program.